Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So this week we're taking a break. Here is an interview from our archive with Maxine Benaber-Clark. Hope you enjoy it.
Because it's time. It's time for reparations.
So I'm sick of being a side Indian character.
LGBTIQ rights are black rights.
It's like, it's a form of cultural imperialism.
The only thing I have in common with this character is that she's black. This does not look like me.
I'm Gary Foley.
I'm Francesca Ramsey.
This is Amir Rahman.
And you're listening to The Race Card.
And Maxine, it's really great having you on the show, and we've been talking about getting on for some time, and I guess tell us a little bit of yourself and give our listeners who may not have heard of Maxine Benaber-Clark yet, but will very, very soon, about who you are.
I'm a writer. I'm of Afro-Caribbean heritage, Australian born, and I started out primarily as a slam poet, so kind of doing performance poetry around the place. And more recently, I've published a collection of stories called Foreign Soil.
Interesting. I guess you're of Afro-Caribbean descent, and I think also British?
Yeah, well, my parents grew up in London. They were both born in the West Indies, so in Jamaica and Guyana, but they both grew up in London and then migrated to Australia in the mid-70s.
Interesting. And I guess a lot of people think of a lot of black Afro-black people in the Caribbean are of Caribbean descent. And actually, at Black Voices, we had a colour come on and he was talking about Brixton, about in the 70s and 80s basically being Jamaica, basically. You were in a different place. And where did your parents grow up? Where did your parents live when they were in the UK?
So they have lived in various places, Tottenham, Walthamstow. But I guess, yeah, around that time, the kind of late 60s to late 70s, there was kind of the first generation, I guess, of British-born people from the Caribbean. Migration started kind of around the mid-50s, and so you suddenly had this generation of black kids that essentially were British born but with Caribbean roots. So I think that kind of fostered a really particular culture in certain areas of London.
Interesting. And I guess I know from a mutual friend of ours that you went to the Slavery Museum in Liverpool. How was that?
Yeah, I was researching the second. So I've got a memoir coming out later next year called The Hate Race, which is really about growing up black in middle-class Australia, white middle-class Australia. And as a kind of, I guess, sequel to that, I wanted to go back and try and trace my family's roots. So I was awarded something called the Hazel Rowley Fellowship for Biography, which allowed me to go to London at the start of this year in January and do a bit of a research trip. And yeah, one of the places I went to was the International Slavery Museum in Liverpool, which was absolutely haunting, as you can imagine. I mean, I kind of, you know a lot about slavery from reading, from watching documentaries or Hollywoodizations of the slave trade, but to actually go there and see the extent of it and see original kind of items of torture and testimonies from slaves was just horrific. Yeah.
Must have been, I guess, very kind of, because obviously being of Afro-Caribbean descent, a lot of the slaves were from that part of the world, and I guess specifically with your parents living there for some time as well, must have brought up some memory, not necessarily memories, but just some scars you didn't know were there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we kind of talk about racism as if it's this contemporary thing, forgetting that it has this, you know, hundreds and hundreds of year history of, you know, black people being suppressed by white people, beaten by white people, raped by white people. And I think we just kind of often don't think of that. We think of racism as someone yelling something on a train. But to actually go, oh, yeah, you know, this actually has a really serious foundation, and the things that were done at that time are really the basis for contemporary racism.
And I guess people don't usually think about racism and kind of like resource extraction, think about the loss of land, the loss of wealth, the loss of history.
Mm. Absolutely. And I did a lot of kind of talks when I was there, so tours of London and things like that. And one of the tours that I did was you went around and looked at various motifs. And there was things like, you know, the Cutlers Guild of London, who their emblem is like two elephants holding up a shield because they were using ivory from taken from India for the handles of the cutlery. And so there's kind of this massive legacy of just, you know, conquering and raping the entire world to get these resources that he's kind of left in Britain that doesn't really get talked about that often now. You know, it's kind of like, oh, that was the past and this is now. But I mean, that's kind of the foundation of the division of the world, you know, the third world and the first world.
Why do you think there's not necessarily that discussion, particularly in Britain, because we usually associate discussions of race to America. America is the most racist place in the world, and things like that. But we don't usually talk about if there was no Britain, there'd not be an America. Mm. There'd not be the people, the origins of the people of white Americans stem from Britain, basically.
Mm, yeah, it's a really interesting one. I mean, I think it's partly that kind of faux politeness of English society that you just don't talk about things that were, you know, in the past. And even, I think even I interviewed some family members of my grandmother's generation, and even some of them were reluctant to actually, when I interviewed them about, you know, how were things when you arrived in England and, you know, what was the racism like, very reluctant to talk about those things because I think it's that that generational, you know, you don't want to upset the status quo, you don't want to go into talking about these disturbing things, you just get on with life.
Interesting. Aranthi?
Oh, I was just, I just heard that some of your work is being taught in schools. Mm. I was just wondering, how do you feel about the importance of diverse education in terms of writing and in terms of what is being taught in especially Australian schools and British schools?
I think it's really, really important that we have diverse voices on the school curriculum. I mean, when I was at school, it was like Shakespeare, George Orwell, Jane Austen. That was pretty much all there was. I think the closest thing to my experience was like Looking for Ella Brandy, which was about an Italian girl, you know. And yeah, so to have my work, there's a few local schools in the kind of West that are studying my work, like Werribee Secondary College is doing it for Year 11. And I think to have stuff that is not necessarily set in white Australia and for kids to see reflections of themselves, it's so important. You know, I didn't encounter literature like that until I was out of high school. And I think had I been exposed to black writers or, you know, non-Anglo-Australian writers at an early age, it would have made my journey so much easier.
Like, I remember, I'm pretty sure everyone's seen Chimamanda's TED Talk about The Single Story. Mm. And if you haven't, check it out. And she basically said she couldn't conceptualize African or specifically to her, where she's from, Nigerian writers. She could not conceptualize a story that included herself or someone who looked like her. Mm. And exactly, reading, writing, visual kind of like movies and TV and everything like that change our perspective, change our, I guess, the way we see the world. How impactful is reading diverse writers, reading black and brown people talking about their stories?
I think it's huge. I mean, particularly when you're young, it validates your life and your experience. And it says, one, that your experience is important enough to go down in writing and go down in history. And also that you have the right to tell your story. I think when I started out in creative writing, I was writing about white people. You know, like I was a student in high school and I just never gave any thought to making a character a brown person because it was like, there's no Australian stories with, you know, non-Indigenous black people in them. How can I write that kind of thing? So I think just that going, oh, yeah, you know, when I went to Werribee High School, they kind of went, one of your stories is set in Footscray. You know, we all know Footscray. We've been there. We've eaten there. We've, you know, lived there. And it was kind of this realization that, yes, you know, our experience is important and it does, it's a story that does deserve to be told.
Yeah, definitely. And also, you did this very, like, it still resonates with me today. Your poem at the Cornwall West event a few months ago when you talked about what we know today as AFL and Mangrok. And I guess talk to us about that and the process of your writing.
So, yeah, it's a poem called Mangrook, and essentially it was inspired by the Adam Goods story, not so much this year, but kind of the first incident that happened where a 13-year-old girl was racially abusing him, and just came from me, I guess, watching that and thinking, this is absurd.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Because this is an Indigenous game that we're talking about. This is somebody playing an Indigenous game on their own land, which has been stolen from them. And I think that just those basic facts weren't talked about. You know, it was all about kind of, should Adam Goods be tougher? Should we hold this 13-year-old girl responsible? You know, maybe it was her parents' fault. And those kind of fundamental discussion of why this might be wrong or why this might be upsetting wasn't there. And so I wanted to write a spoken word piece that spoke to that and that kind of explored this history of dispossession and, you know, that thing of having to stand on your stolen land, sing a national anthem that doesn't speak to your experience, that's not your, not sung in your language, and then at the end of all of that to have this experience where someone is abusing you. And yeah, I mean, it's a piece that I took quite a long time to write, and I guess I was really mindful of, you know, I'm not an Indigenous person. How do I speak to this experience without kind of co-opting the Indigenous voice or experience?
Interesting. Like, I guess in a more broader sense, with your writing, how do you, what is your process, and I guess how have you found your own voice while writing, with in mind of, as you said, you started writing about white people and you didn't conceptualize a time when you could write about someone who looked just who looked like you and who had similar experiences?
I think that's just come with time and also reading broadly. I think the fact that I was never exposed at high school to people like Toni Morrison or Alice Walker or people who weren't necessarily writing into my experience, or even, you know, Indigenous writers, we didn't read any. I think Sally Morgan was on the curriculum, but we didn't study it. And so just being exposed to other writers and realizing that actually there are thousands of stories out there, and if my story is not out there, then maybe I need to write it. You know, maybe that's something I can do.
I guess, like, on that note, how did you find the process of trying to get published as a black writer, especially within Australia with, I guess, a kind of small group of black writers here?
Very difficult. my poetry, I published with, I was lucky enough to find a really small press, a Picoro Press, which now I think has been acquired by Janindera Press in Adelaide. But Rob Reel there really liked my poetry and was willing to put it out, but it was a very small one-man operation, so it was pretty much he would produce the books and everything else was up to me. So in terms of promoting it, trying to get it into bookstores was quite difficult. And then with Foreign Soil, my short fiction collection, I probably spent about 2.5 years trying to get it published, and it did the rounds, you know, did the rejection rounds of almost every publisher in Australia, I reckon, and then eventually won something called the Premier's Award for an unpublished manuscript, and that was very much a door opener. You know, every single thing that's happened in my career in the last kind of 2 years stemmed from winning this competition, which I think is great, but also quite sad, because I think there are many versions of me out there who won't win one of these competitions and whose work is probably as good, you know, if not better than mine. And so I guess I hope that as more people of colour get published, you know, doors start to open.
One of the things I'd really like to ask you about is the idea of the black writer and adding that extra element to it, and then this idea that because you are a black writer or a person of colour writing about anything, basically, it has to inadvertently be political. And you have to, in a sense, perform, whether it be blackness, for a crowd. And I guess, how do you navigate that while trying to just write what you want to write?
I guess for a long time I wasn't navigating that. I wanted to talk about blackness because I felt the narrative wasn't out there. And it's only really in the last year that I've started to go, okay, I feel like I've dealt with the things I want to deal with in terms of putting my version of the story out there or representing people like me. How do I now go forward? And I've been lucky enough to have been thrown a few opportunities outside of that. So I do a bit of work for the Saturday paper, writing profiles of, you know, just basically interesting people that I meet along the road, or, you know, people like actors or, you know, chefs, comedians. And so that's been really great for me in terms of going, okay, I don't just have to write about race. It is interesting and fun to do other things. And also that external recognition that, you know, yes, we don't have to just call Maxine when something happens that's race related and we need an opinion piece. And I think that can be a danger that writers of colour get boxed in, not only internally, but externally by editors and by publishers. It's like, no, you have to write that race narrative.
Do you feel that is, in a sense, limiting as well? Because for me as well, like in my writing, in not into the scale of yours, obviously, but in the sense of feeling that you have to economize your trauma, basically, and how that's more a sense acceptable in a very mainstream white audience who, in a sense, by listening or reading your writing, feels, in a sense, more moral and more upstanding.
I think absolutely. I think particularly in memoirs, white readers love the black or the writer of colour trauma narrative that, you know, I've had a hard life, that I've come from poverty and I've, you know, either risen above or ended up in jail, you know. And, you know, while that is, it's a valid narrative, I think particularly for my memoir, I wanted to write about middle class Australia because I very much grew up in suburbia, and I think that's a really interesting, you know, we often, when we talk about racism, we talk about rednecks, you know, reclaim Australia, people who potentially don't have a, you know, a high level of education, whereas I wanted to talk about this kind of casual, insidious racism that you get in suburban Australia that is very much not explored. And so I guess I've tried to find ways of doing things differently in terms of the, you know, the narrative and what my story is, and trying not to play into that kind of narrative that everyone wants you to write because it sells.
It does. And how do you do that while managing to have a family and two children?
I don't sleep. No, I think, you know, like that's kind of almost true. You know, I think as a creative person, particularly up until about 4 years ago, I was working a legal job as well. That's kind of my other career. And so balancing that, how much can I of my creative self can I give before it starts to impact on my family time or impact on the other work that I'm doing? I've been lucky enough that in the last year and a half, I've been able to actually make a living off writing and teaching and speaking and things like that, which makes it a bit easier. But, you know, it's just, I guess I look at it as work. You know, it's fun work, but, you know, I look at it as a job.
Oh, yeah. I guess sort of finally, what I found in Australia, that even though the community of writers of colour is really small, the community is really strong. I was just wondering, like, how have you found the support of other writers of colour in Australia to be, especially in getting published and getting jobs?
I think it's been absolutely extraordinary. You know, for me, when I was trying to get Foreign Soil published, you know, I needed to get people to endorse it, you know, so quotes that you put on the cover or whatever. So approaching people like Alice Pung and Randa Abdel-Fattah, Tony Birch, people who are, you know, have been working in that fiction world or non-fiction world as writers of color for a very long time. And they were just so generous and so ready to give of their time and supportive. And I do think that even though the community is small, there is this sense of solidarity. We all recognize how difficult it is. And when someone new comes along, it's like, yeah, you know, another person's made it through the door. Quick, pull them in, you know. So I think it's great. You know, there's a real sense of camaraderie there.
Yeah, definitely. And I've noticed it myself just by just messaging someone like you, for example. I messaged you a few weeks ago and said, can you come on the race card? And you're like, sure, what time? When, yeah. What, you know, and it's that easy. And, yeah. And people listening at home or wherever you're listening, in the car or whatever, you know, you can listen wherever you want. You know, just message someone, send them, shoot them an email, whatever it is. And, you know, you'll be surprised by the response. You really will be. And finally, thank you so much, Maxine, for coming
on
the show.
Thanks for having me.